Playing video and computer games was once mainly seen as something kids and teens did, but in recent years, they've become a popular diversion for adults as well. Jay McGonigal, who's a game developer, predicts that we'll soon be living in a world where everyone is a gamer. Her new book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World, is published by Penguin Press. Very pleased that it has brought Jay McGonigal to our show today. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Is everyone a gamer? I hope that's not true. I know lots of people who have no interest in playing video or computer games.
Well, I think the key is games. I mean, almost everyone plays games of some kind. We do know that 183 million people in the United States are playing computer and video games, but increasingly the games that we're playing are more connected to real life. They have more physical movement, or they're played in real world spaces, or they deal with real world problems. So someone who might not want to battle with orcs in a fantasy world might still want to play a game that helps them spend more time with their grandkids or helps them contribute to a cure for cancer.
Well, we should look at some of the statistics you cite in your book. 69% of all heads of households play computer and video games. 97% of youth play them. 40% of gamers are women, and one out of four gamers is over the age of 50. Where do those numbers come from?
They come from the largest annual industry survey, the Electronic Software Association, trying to figure out who the market is for games. It's the largest industry study of its kind.
Of course, as you suggested earlier, we're talking about a wide range of definitions of the word game. Most of them, as far as I can tell, involve shooting enemies before they shoot you.
And are you a gamer? Because I would guess you only think that that's true because you don't actually spend much time playing games. Actually, if you look at the top 20 best-selling games from the past year or the past 5 years, usually 15 of the games are not violent whatsoever. They're racing or sports or puzzles or adventure or dance games. And then maybe you have five that are more involving shooting and blowing things up. So that is a little bit of a misperception.
One of the more controversial argument you have here is that life doesn't deliver the goods like a video game, that reality is depressing and trivial. Really? Trivial and depressing?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's – I do say that life is depressing, reality is depressing. I say that it's hard and can be lonely and can be frustrating and can be boring, and I think that's absolutely true.
That's only because we've been watching the news.
No, I think and by the way, I don't want to spoil the surprise ending of the book, but the last chapter is called Reality is Better. I'm not arguing that we should aspire to spend 20 or 40 hours a week in front of our screens. What I'm saying is we have an opportunity today to look at exactly what it is that games are provoking in us and then take that into our real lives.
Well, what reasons do gamers give for why they like to play games?
Yeah, it basically boils down to two things. One is the positive emotions that it provokes. So games provoke very strong feelings of optimism, of confidence, of motivation.
That's only if you do well.
No, it's not. In fact, gamers spend 80% of their time failing in games. That's one of the most interesting pieces of research I found while I was writing the book. So we think that games are this sort of easy way to feel good about yourself. But can you imagine if you spent 80% of the time failing at something in real life, you would stop doing it. You wouldn't necessarily try harder and hang in there.
From your perspective, as a creator of games, as a designer, what elements are necessary to make the gaming experience successful?
Yeah, the first thing is a goal that somebody can really rally around. And then you want to provide them feedback on how well they're achieving that goal or getting closer to that goal. We like to see social elements, particularly cooperative gaming is really one of the best innovations in gaming over the past few years.
So, are you talking about people playing Scrabble online something more complicated than that?
Yeah, certainly many games are more complicated than Scrabble online. The most popular games today are cooperative games where you and four friends or 25 friends or even 250 strangers collaborate together to achieve a common goal. So you could think of when you play Rock Band with your family and you're all playing the same song together. You play Left 4 Dead with your friends. You're trying to survive a zombie apocalypse together. But it's intensely cooperative. It's not this sort of old idea that gamers want to beat each other.
You're right that in real life, we often don't get to see the direct impact of our efforts. Whereas if we're playing a game, the impact is immediate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're looking
for... So are we talking about instant gratification or are we talking about something else?
It's not exactly instant gratification. It is the ability to feel like we're operating not in a vacuum, but rather in a context that where we have feedback, know how we're doing. In fact, there's been interesting research lately looking at quality of life at the workplace. And it shows that if you want to make somebody happier at work, you don't give them a promotion, you don't get them more money, you give them the chance to do something that they feel like they've made progress. And so we're looking at ways of visualizing progress in the real world, whether it's Nike Plus when you're running, it keeps track of your miles and your speed, more like a game, or even new platforms like Foursquare, where it keeps track of how many times you've seen your friends and how many times you've gone out, so that your social life is actually, you feel like you're making progress and actually having more of a life.
You write about alternate reality games and mention a popular one called Chore Wars, where players compete by performing real-life chores.
Yeah.
How popular is that?
Well, you know, it's not like World of Warcraft, 13 million players and strong and counting, but it's very popular with families who are trying desperately to find peace in the household. You know, how do I get my husband to do something around the house? How do I get my kids to not argue with me every time I ask them to make their bed? This game gives you a way to let other people in your house opt in, get some online treasure, fight some online bad guys, and actually help around the house.
Well, let's talk about World of Warcraft, one of the most popular computer games. The goal there is to make your avatar stronger, better, richer. All extrinsic rewards that experts say don't lead to lasting happiness.
Well, it's true that extrinsic rewards don't lead to lasting happiness. If you actually get financial gains, if you get real world status improvement. The interesting thing about in these virtual worlds is, you know, gamers aren't compensated for playing. If they earn virtual loot, it doesn't really link to their real life bank accounts. They're not necessarily gaining status for playing because, as you said, a lot of people look down on gaming and look down on it as a waste of time.
Despite the fact that 69% of all heads of households play computer games.
Well, and many of them are playing with their kids, which is really one of the reasons why we see the gap is shrinking, because parents want to spend quality time with their kids and their kids want to play games.
They're also introducing games into schools, aren't they? Because kids, as you point out, 97% play games. I'm surprised that 3% don't, because I have yet to meet a kid who doesn't play some game, whether it's a sports game or actually they play a whole range of games. They may prefer to play basketball or baseball, or whatever, but invariably they're going to be with a friend trying to kill some terrible zombie.
Well, yes, not inevitably. You know, the most popular game is a game called Cityville, 110 million players, and they're just doing simulations of designing cities. So I just, you know, want to make sure we throw that out there.
But for young architects?
Aspiring, maybe someday. But, you know, this idea that we could change our schools with games is really important to me. Both my parents are public school teachers, so I know how hard it is to engage kids. You know, educators talk about it as this engagement gap, that kids are so used to being empowered to be creative and collaborative and pursue goals that they're personally interested in when they play games. They show up to the classroom and they wonder, why can't I be engaged in the same way? Why does it feel so different?
Well, the types of games we're talking about require getting people to participate in a real activity. Aren't these games more likely to be taken on by someone who's inclined to that particular activity?
Yeah, it's true that some of the new games where you can help cure cancer or work towards stopping climate change do ask you to do something in the real world to make an effort. And what I've been researching is what is the likelihood of gamers actually getting involved in that. And there's some really promising numbers. You know, earlier this year, a game invented by scientists at the University of Washington, they were able to get 57,000 gamers to contribute so many hours to the game that when the scientists published a paper in Nature Journal, they listed every single one of these 57,000 gamers as co-authors for a scientific paper about new medicines for cancer.
You spend considerable time talking about using games for major social impact, like what happened in 2009 when The Guardian of Britain created a game to investigate corruption among the members of parliament. Mm-hmm. And that was a big success? How much corruption did they turn up?
They turned up a lot of corruption. Yeah, I mean, they weren't, the Guardian wasn't the only paper investigating it, but they were the fastest moving investigators because they enlisted gamers in the UK to help sort through these online documents that the government had dumped and redacted and scanned so many times they were barely legible. And as a result of all the headlines that came out of this game, that many members of parliament resigned over this corruption, and new legislation was passed to prevent it in the future.
Haven't you partnered with several organizations to design games for change, most recently with the World Bank Institute?
That's right. I did a game last year called Evoke, which you can still play online today. And it's a 10-week crash course in changing the world. By the end of the game, you have a business plan for a real-world social venture that you could start. You've identified mentors. And when we ran it as our pilot study last year, we engaged just under 20,000 young people from 130 countries, and they launched 51 real social enterprises at the end of 10 weeks.
Although this is more likely to be something that someone from a first-world country would be able to do than a third-world country, because there aren't all that many computers.
Fortunately, we were working with the World Bank Institute, which has great access to community organizers throughout developing areas of the world. We were able to partner with a number of learning groups in places like Uganda, Nigeria, South Africa to really engage young people who might not otherwise be playing computer games.
You've said that you would like to see a game developer win the Nobel Peace Prize. I don't know whether that's something that we're likely to see in a while, but what would be required for that to happen?
There are two things, really, I think, possible paths to winning the Nobel Peace Prize. The first is making these games that really do solve a real problem. You know, if a cure for cancer comes out of a game like the one that was played this year by the 57,000 gamers, that would be one path to a Nobel Peace Prize. There's also the possibility that simply by using games to raise quality of life, to treat depression, to treat anxiety, to treat social alienation, which we know from scientific research that I write about in the book, we know that this is possible.
You get people who are feeling disengaged involved?
Yeah, you get them involved. You get people really to re-engineer their quality of life. And that could be worth a Nobel Peace Prize someday.
Jay McGonigal is Director of Game Research and Development at the Institute for the Future. Her work has been featured in The Economist, Wired, The New York Times, MTV, CNN, and even National Public Radio. Her book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.